Hello and welcome to the latest instalment of the William Hill Sports Book of the Year podcast. I'm Joe Crilly and my podcasting pal Ollie Blackwell has returned for this, the penultimate preview episode. So Ollie, what can the listeners expect on today's show?
Yeah, so you spoke to Clark Carlisle earlier, so that's going to form the second half of the episode. You spoke to him about Run or Die by Kilian Jornet. That's his book for our book club chat. But before that, I spoke to author Rick Riley, who is our fifth shortlisted author to be interviewed. So he was talking about his book on the shortlist, Commander in Cheat. So Rick has previously written for both ESPN and Sports Illustrated. He's also penned a number of sports books on golf in the past, including Who's Your Caddy, when he caddied for celebrities, including the aforementioned person in the book, Donald Trump. So Rick was once described by USA Today as the closest thing sports writing has ever had to a rock star. But his writing in Commander in Cheat is probably closer to the equivalent of heavy metal, I'd say, as Rick launches stinging attack after stinging attack on President Trump's moral failings on the course and how this might explain his antics off the course as well. So the result is both entertaining and full of staggering, you know, I just could not believe it, stories about Trump and his relationship with the game. And it's clear from our chat earlier that Rick is not happy. He's not a happy chappy about the idea of Trump influencing and basically devaluing the sport that he loves. So I began all this by asking him, at what point did he realise that he could literally fill a book on President Trump's antics in the game?
September of 2015, we live in Italy 3 months a year during the fall, because who doesn't want to do that? And anyway, I was sitting there drinking my Campari like a normal person, and I saw for about the fifth time him telling campaigns crowds, I'm a winner, I've won 18 club championships, and that's against the best players in the club, and that's with no strokes. I'm like, you fat liar. You told me already, because I've known the guy 30 years, already told me how you won him, which is whenever you buy a new golf course, he plays the first round by himself, and maybe Melania's in the cart. And then unless Melania gets really hot, he's going to win the club championship. And he goes, pretty smart, huh? And I'm like, diabolical, yes. Yeah. And yet I never dreamed he would be telling people that's the reason to vote for him for president. So no, of course, a lot of people cheat at golf. I've never seen a guy cheat like this. But nobody uses it as a reason that he should be president. I mean, I've always said golf is like bicycle shorts. It reveals a lot about a person, about a guy. Yeah. And golf, and it really does with him. He cheats like a mafia accountant.
One thing I guess we should state is that his exact handicap, it's still okay. Yeah. But is that what makes it just ridiculous?
I'd say he's good. He's not quite good. I mean, for instance, he says he's a 2.8 handicap. Now, if you look up right now Jack Nicklaus's handicap, it's 3.5. So who would you want? Loser has to, you know, sweep the streets of Baghdad the rest of your life. Yeah. You'd want Nicklaus, right?
Yeah, it's close.
Donald Trump is not a 2.8 handicap. So you look on the handicap computer where we all put our scores. They do it in England. They do it here. And he has posted in 8 years only 20 times. In 8 years. Mm. So he's just cherry picking his best scores. And then he lies about the difficulty of the course, fakes the number there. So it looks like he's a 3 handicap. But any pro I've got, Tiger Woods, Annika Sorenstam, they all say he's about a 9, 10, 11. Then some video came out of him in Ireland trying to chip up a hill. He chips like Edward Scissorhands. He's just got terrible, terrible hands. So he tried 3 times and failed to hit a simple little chip up a 20-yard hill. And somebody, but it hasn't happened in America because he always plays behind his iron gates of his courses, but somebody videotaped it, and his stance is all wrong. It's all wristy. Even his big swing, I mean, he's got a big full swing, but it's really flat like a pancake. So I've got a $100,000 standing offer that I can beat him straight up with my 5.2 and his 2.8, as long as not at one of his cheating courses with one of his cheating caddies, and each one of us gets a R&A rules guy behind us.
When's that going to take
place? And he has not touched that bet.
Well, you mentioned you've collected all these testimonies from far and wide, and we can see that Trump's influence on the game is massive. In terms of the golf courses he seems to own and build, it sometimes feels like he's just shaping this sport to suit his will, as it were. Where does this come from?
But you said his influence on the game is massive.
Yeah.
It's massively disgusting. I mean, we had Rory and we had Tiger and we had Jason Day, guys, you know, who are athletes. We were doing better. More and more people were walking again. We were bringing golf back to the public, you know, for, you know, 30, 40 bucks. You can play a great round of golf and walk with your friends. And now here comes this fat guy in his 1995 Dockers, and he's cheating, and he's riding in a cart, and he's driving the carts on the green, and he's only playing with famous people, and he's only playing at his courses, and he's set golf back about 50 years. It makes me sick. He's left a big orange splotch on the game I love, and me and my family and I have played this game. I mean, I have a 90-year-old aunt who still wins her, you know, her flight. Now, she's the only person in the flight, but still, she finishes the nine hole. And this guy is ruining my game.
In the book, we definitely get a sense of just how scathing and seething you are at this. But so I guess some of the funniest bits are when you just kind of just faithfully and painstakingly just lay out exactly all the instances of Trump being a cheat in all his misdemeanors. Now, how hard is it with all this stuff to not get caught up in that frustration and emotion and just to stick to, you know, all the facts, all the testimonies you gather to just include those as they are, as it were?
It's easy. I mean, everybody had a story. I mean, the guy tried to cheat Tiger Woods. He's playing with Tiger Woods against him in a match.
Yeah.
Tiger's on one side of the fairway. Trump and his partner on the other side. It's his second shot. He's got to hit it over water. He chunks it into the water.
Yeah.
And he says to the partner, who, by the way, is a pro touring pro himself named Brad Faxon, "Fax, throw me another ball. Tiger didn't see." And Faxon's like, "What? Throw me another ball. He didn't see. He's Tiger Woods. Throw it." So so Faxon throws him another ball. He chunks that in the water. Then they jump in the golf cart, because whenever you play with Trump, he's always 200 yards ahead of you, so he can kick it and fudge it and foozle it and whatever. So he hurries ahead, drops, hits it onto the in front of the water onto the green. Tiger hits it in like a foot, and then Tiger says, "What are you putting for, Mr. President?" You know, because they're playing for money. Mm. And the president says, "I'm putting four for a three." I mean, we already know it's 7 for a 6 at best. And I mean, so it's so easy just to lay out exactly what he's done. So many people have told me stories. I wrote another chapter for the paperback, which is even crazier, which comes out in April. And then, so here in America, I did book signings all over.
Yeah.
And, but this is a new thing. There's a library in Idaho. And they have one of my books. Well, somebody keeps hiding it in other parts of the library. And so they have to go find it because they see that it hasn't been checked out. And they find it in some, you know, odd historical section or whatever, fiction.
Wow.
And there's a note attached every time. And the note says something like, "Your liberal angst gives me pleasure." Or one time he said, "I don't want propaganda like this ending up in the hands of young minds." And I'm like, A, I didn't know young minds had hands. And B, I'm shocked a Trumper went to a library. So this is striking me as fake news. So I'm going up there next week with 10 books. And I'm going to hide them all over this library in sections that seem more appropriate. For instance, true crime, mental illness, children's, you know. And if you find those books, you can keep them.
Oh, that's brilliant. We're picking one fight at a time. That's very good. So you mentioned this in the book, he's certainly not the first US president to be fascinated with golf and to play golf. But there's a few instances you mentioned. There's other examples of presidents cheating. I mean, we meet Bill Clinton in the book on a few of his rounds. What do you think about?
I played with Clinton. Yeah, when he was president, and he cheated.
Yeah.
But in a much simpler and sort of, if cheating can be innocent, his was more innocent. Right. It's like the guy that goes into the bank and steals the pen, you know, and the guy that steals the vault. But Clinton just wanted to steal the pen. Right. So Clinton, hardly I got to play much. He got to play maybe once a month, maybe once every 2 months. So I got to play with him when he was president. And first of all, he had 24 clubs in the bag, which is slightly over the club limit. You're supposed to have 10 club by 10. And then he didn't take mulligans. He took what we call billigans. So he'd hit his shot and he'd play that shot, but he'd say, let me try that again. And he would hit extra shots. And then the caddy would have to go pick them up. And then he'd hit six or seven of these because he never got to play and he just wanted to practice. That's totally illegal, by the way. Yeah. But he would play the first one, but then he would sometimes forget which was his first one because all the balls were the same with the presidential logo. They'd say, which is my first ball? And the Secret Service would go, I think it's the one near the pin, Mr. President. Like, yeah, it sure is. And in that way, he shot his best round of his life that day, 82. But there was no money. He wasn't going around saying he was a 3 handicap. He wasn't telling the world he was a club champion. He was just a very slow golfer that just loved golf and wasn't able to get out.
I mean, most of us would be pretty horrified, I'd say, if we were the subject of some of the conclusions that you reach about Trump in the book. Now, I guess we can only speculate on this, whether he's read it or not. But if the US president has read it, what do you think he would make of it?
A, I'm dying for the guy to tweet about it. He won't tweet about it. So one of my best buddies is one of his best buddies. And I'm afraid that he went to him and said, don't try to get in a Twitter war with this guy. You'll lose. Yeah. And also, I'm dying for him to tweet about it because sales would go straight up. So I even wrote a tweet what I think he'd say. And it would be something like, Rick Riley, that book's all fake. I kicked his ass, which he... I did lose $10 to him, but he took 7 mulligans. He even took the first ever gimme chip in. I've never seen that before. He's not even on the green. And he goes, that makes this good. So yeah, he kicked my ass at cheating.
Just quickly break down what a mulligan is for those who haven't read the book. It is an extraordinary.
Oh, well, a mulligan is sometimes you're allowed among friends a second try at your first shot of the day. So you hit your first shot, it goes in the spinach, and take a mulligan there, Charlie. And Charlie hits another one, and he has to play that one. This guy took 7 of them all over the course all day. One time he took one because a bird flew too low. It's insane. So anyway, his tweet would go something like, Rick Riley, fake news. I kicked his ass.
Yeah.
He paid me $10. Don't believe anything you hear from this guy. And then I was going to tweet back, okay, who read you the book?
You're listening to the William Hill Sports Book of the Year podcast.
So that was Rick Riley talking about his book, Commander in Cheat, which is on the shortlist this year. Now, Joe, you sat down with Clark Carlisle earlier to talk about one of his favourite sports book, Run or Die by Kilian Jornet. What did you talk about?
Yeah, that's right. Clark and I had a chat about Run or Die earlier, a book that he thinks, in his own words, is the one that got away. It was shortlisted in 2014, but missed out to Anna Crean's Night Games, which was a book about sexual abuse in Australian rules football. Now, in 2014, Kilian Jornet was the superstar of ultra running, and his book Run or Die is, in a way, his journal into how he reached the top of the sport and chronicles some of his most impressive victories. The book is less an autobiography with only a small portion attributed to his childhood and more a study on how he got to the top and the lengths he goes to in order to stay there. Now, Jornet was only 25 when this book was written, and sometimes you can tell that's the case with the book sometimes slipping into self-absorption and much of the writing being in the present tense. However, this doesn't jar with the content of the book. Instead, it complements it and reminds us throughout that the author is still so young. I spoke to Clark about why he chose this book above all others.
Well, I actually remember that judging panel because I was torn myself between the two books. Run or Die is one of the greatest sports books I feel I've ever read. But that year, Anna's book was about an incredibly important topic that I didn't feel had been covered as well as that before. So, you know, in the discussion, the deliberations went long into the night. But Run or Die, I have certain criteria for sports books that I believe elevates them into the shortlist and potential winners. And one of them is talking about a sport or an activity that I know very little about. And another is the author's ability to take me into that world. And when I read, I don't know about you, Joe, I don't know about other people, but I visualize a movie in my own mind as I read. And this book was just absolutely beautiful. Honestly, it took me scene by scene through the guy's life and in a very, very different way. You know, it wasn't, oh, I ran this race and I felt that and I did this injury. I thought it was one of the first literary pieces that I'd read around sport and around ultra running as well. You know, this was a sport that I just can't fathom. I still can't.
Yeah.
I still don't get it. You know, I understand how guys and girls can run for 24, 48, 36 hours with little or no sleep. But he had the ability to take me there. And the final thing that I thought elevated it to potential winner status was the fact that it was a translation as well.
Yeah.
You know, the book, it wasn't even the primary language of the book. And that just blew me away.
Well, it is quite poetic, isn't it, in parts of the book. And I've kind of drawn a comparison myself. I don't know whether you got this as well. I think it's similar to a couple of books that we've got on the shortlist this year. First of all, I think it's similar to Rough Magic. It's also similar to another more obvious book on the shortlist, but we can get to that in a little bit. But it's similar to Rough Magic in my mind because the narrator is so young and the way that the book is written, it sounds like it's coming from a young person's mouth. At times it can be a little self-aggrandizing, but I mean, what 25-year-old wouldn't be if you'd done everything that he had
exactly by
that point? But do you think that the fact that he is so young and it's written like a 25-year-old would write, do you see that as part of the charm of the book as well?
Most definitely. And I wouldn't choose the term self-aggrandizing because if you see a 25-year-old who had achieved what he had achieved to that point in something that a sport that is so brutal, you know, you would imagine that running one ultra marathon, especially for us in our sedentary lifestyles, it would kibosh us for 3, 4, 5 months.
Yeah.
You know, but this guy was going out on run after run after run, achieving what he achieved. So I think if he played it down, there would have been a false modesty about it.
Yeah.
There'd have been a genuine false humility, wouldn't have enabled the reader to grasp the magnitude of what he was achieving. So I really, really liked it. And that comparison to Rough Magic, I thought it was an incredible book. And the similarity is what you alluded to earlier. It was so poetic. One of the first books that stood out for me was The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. I mention it every year. I think my fellow judges are sick of me mentioning it. But it's because as a former athlete, I totally understand and relate to that point in activity or exercise where your physical exhaustion is so that your body switches off and your mind almost takes you to a safe place. And that safe place can be as arbitrary as there are people on the earth. Honestly, it's incredible. You find yourself thinking about shopping lists, thinking about the potential for toenail clippings to be a future energy source, you know, just random things like that. And I think in both Run or Die and Rough Magic, that both authors encapsulate that, the total randomness of the mind when you're pushing your body to its limit. And like I said, I can relate to that. It's almost like a self-preservation measure where your brain tries to take you away from the real physical punishment of what you're doing and comforts you, you know, consoles you in amongst what you're doing. And I think both authors encapsulate that perfectly.
Going on to another book that we've had shortlisted this year, there's another ultra running book, Darren Ann Finn's Rise of the Ultra Runners. And in both that book and this one, we see a great deal of mental struggle. Now, I, coming from a complete layperson, and this is a layperson who struggles to get up the stairs, let alone run a marathon or an ultra marathon. But from a layperson's view and from your point of view, having read both those books, do you think the sport of ultra running is the cause of the mental fatigue, or do you think it attracts people who want to experience that mental fatigue and push themselves to the limit?
Ooh, that's very much a chicken or the egg situation. Yeah. And I don't think you can have a binary answer. I think if you canvassed the field an ultra marathon, I think you would find the spectrum of people with those thoughts. You know, you would have those like Killian Jornet, who ludicrously was born into ultra running. Yeah. You know, the guy's doing his first ultra run at 2 years of age, you know, up on the mountain trails with his family. It's absolutely ludicrous. Yet you get someone like Darren Ann Finn, who has almost stumbled into it out of curiosity, you know, because he had his parameters set about what running was, and stepping into ultra running, you know, kind of blew his expectations and understanding of a sport that he loved. But then throughout it, and this is what I really liked about Finn's book, is he goes and interviews numerous ultra runners around the world, and you find certain runners, like her name eludes me, but the American lady who started running as part of her self-care for coping with a mental health issue, and accidentally stumbled onto the fact that she could run for 24 hours straight, you know. And this, I think, is a fantastic metaphor for life. We keep ourselves within our boxes of experience. So I am quite sure that there, I'm not going to say hundreds, but I reckon just in England alone, there are dozens of people who would happen upon the fact that they have the ability to push their body far further than they ever imagined. But because they've never tried or experienced or thought to experience, it isn't even on their radar. So in answer to your question, I think you'll have the whole range of people within the sport whose motivation, let's say, fills every category of mindset that you can imagine.
Finally, and this is more kind of your experience as a judge and your affinity towards Run or Die. We've had a couple of judges on the show already to talk about their favourite books. Alison Rudd on episode one talked about Dark Trade by Donald McCrae, which won the sports book in 1996. However, we've had John Inverdale and Graham Sharp both on, who've chosen books that didn't win the award, that were shortlisted, as you have done. Since you joined the judging panel, do you think this book is the one that got away? And do you think it stuck with you more because it didn't win the award?
Oh, what a really good question. I definitely think that it's one that got away, and it was a victim of timing and circumstance. There are certain books that will win the Sports Book of the Year of the award purely because of the topic that they cover and how important and far-reaching the consequences of that story being told are. The one about Lance Armstrong, namely Anna Creel's book, you know, about the abuse in Australian Aussie rules football. And as we do know, reading and the appreciation of literature is subjective. And as important as a topic may be, if there is a book that is constructed and is written in such a manner that it's of a caliber that refuses to go unacknowledged, then, you know, that book will rise to the top. With regards to Run or Die, I genuinely believe that it's one that got away. I believe that it's a style of writing that was almost a precursor for the likes of Rough Magic, you know, this poetic literature. It wasn't constrained by running in a chronological sense, by running in a times and results and performance sense. It really just conveyed the beauty of what that sport was and what it meant to the individual who was participating in that sport. I think it's almost opened up a whole new genre of sports writing, where the result is irrelevant, where the performances are irrelevant, but the magnificent and the beauty and the aesthetics of the journey are what push to the reader's mind.
Okay, so if you've listened to even one of these podcasts, you know that we've had a competition running throughout, and we are pleased to announce that Twitter feed at BassJam88, Jamie C, has won our Twitter competition. He likes the pinned tweet, and he also gave us a follow at Bookie Prize. So there's going to be 6 signed copies of the shortlisted books winging their way to you. And Jamie, we will see you at the ceremony on the 5th of December. So congratulations.
And just a reminder, if you can't join us at the ceremony next Thursday on the 5th of December, you can watch the live feed as it happens via the William Hill Facebook page, where we'll be covering the entire ceremony in full.
Thank you, Ollie, and thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next time for the final preview show, where we'll be chatting to Donald McRae, talking about his book In Sunshine and Shadow. We've also got a little round table where we'll be discussing the legacy of Lance Armstrong's It's Not About the Bike that won the award in 2000.
The William Hill Sportsbook of the Year podcast is a Muddy Knees Media production.